The yacht was owned by the Vasco Corporation of Wilmington, Delaware. First time I've said this in weeks, but it's too cold in here. Turn that frigid blower off. Turn it plumb off for a few minutes. The yacht was owned by the Vasco Corporation of Wilmington, Delaware, which offered the $2,500 reward for information on the Sabalbank's whereabouts. On April 25th, the Coast Guard gave up the search, which had begun on April 10th and reached as far as Central America. On April 26th, the United Press International dispatched a release, Dateline Miami, that began, quote, a $300,000 yacht on a shakedown cruise may have become the latest victim of the mysterious Devil's Triangle. It was daylight. We'll get back to the mass. It was daylight. But the sun had not yet lifted above the horizon. The weather was clear, balmy. As the motor vessel Atlantic City plied westward, less than a day away from her destination, Newport News, Virginia. A long Atlantic swell running from the east periodically gave the freighter's stern a gentle heave upward. It was a typical summer morning in 1955. Most of the crew were still sleeping. W.J. Morris of Lantrison, South Wales, was on lookout duty atop the Atlantic City's bridge. Soon it would be time to awaken the rest of the crew and ready the ship for entering port. Morris was joined by the officer of the watch, who chatted for a few minutes before returning below to the wheelhouse. Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging and circling erratically. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great... Now let's go back to the mass. Why don't we just go home? Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging and circling erratically. Then the two men saw blank, 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 and heading directly for the ship. It was on a collision course with the Atlantic City. Panicking, Morris began to jump over the wind dodger to the foredeck below. The mate grabbed him and pulled him back to the deck. The two terrified men lay there covering their faces. Hearing no noise whatsoever, they looked up. The blank was nearly upon them. It's blank, 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 blank. The Star of Peace, formerly the Lover Boy, let's leave that one for a minute. The Star of Peace, formerly the Lover Boy, how do you get from one to the other, I don't know, and the Star of the Pacific, was a 138-foot, three-masted schooner with a gross weight of 170 tons. She was built as a yacht in 1924 at the Bethlehem Shipyard in Wilmington, Delaware, for the president of the Studebaker Motor Car Company. Other owners down through the years included Robert Fulian, president of the Schlitz Brewing Company. Are you going to say he was sampling his wares? The daughter of the Colgate toothpaste family and a syndicate of Puerto Rican businessmen. During World War II, the Star of Peace served as... Are you starting to get a little bit convinced the strange goings-on permeate the Bermuda Triangle? During World War II, the Star of Peace served as a Navy coastal patrol craft off the eastern seaboard of the United States. Anybody want to row from Florida to... She's credited with participating in the sinking of two German U-boats. After the war, she was owned by Texas A&M University, used as an oceanographic research ship. In 1971, Conrad McCulloch, a Buffalo, New York fire extinguisher manufacturer, restored the schooner to her original lines. At that time, her name was changed from Star of the Pacific to Star of Peace. McCulloch donated the use of the schooner to the League of Families of POWs of the Vietnam War. In conjunction with this, in 1974-75, the ship made a 41,000-mile voyage to Vietnam to publicize the Nixon administration side of the POW issue, playing a diplomatic role in negotiations between the United States and North Vietnam. The vessel spent 18 months cruising Asiatic waters on behalf of the prisoners of war. The Star of Peace was to sail to Hanoi. However, when it was learned that Jane Fonda and other activists were going to be in the communist city at the same time, it was felt that they might interfere with the mission of the Star of Peace. Thus, the ship headed back to the United States, arrived at her home port, Fort Lauderdale, July 74, on Tuesday. January 28, 1975, the Star of Peace set sail for San Salvador and the Bahamas for several weeks of cruising and diving. Some of McCulloch's business associates were to meet the vessel there. It was good sailing weather on January 30th as the Star of Peace reached along under full sail. The rays of the subtropical winter sun appeared to be dancing on top of the waves. The air was warm. Most of the crew were lazily sitting or standing around the deck. The wind in the rigging, the sound of the sea, and the schooner's heeling hull plunging through the waves were all that broke the silence of the ocean. The only machinery running was below decks, where a small air compressor was being used to fill scuba diving tanks. The vessel was under command of Dan Smith, an executive in McCulloch's firm. Others aboard included John Messer and Jack Kyan, both of Fort Lauderdale, Randy Keith of Merritt Island, Florida, and Jerry Valdiga of Dudley, Massachusetts. Early in the afternoon, Smith went below to check the compressor. The tank being filled registered only 1,500 pounds. A full tank holds 2,200 pounds of air pressure. Another 10 to 15 minutes of filling would do it. The safety tolerance of the tank was over 3,000 pounds. Smith headed topside. Just as he reached the deck, and now let's go to the mast. Back to the mast. But before we get there, another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating out of Key West. You know what I ought to do? I ought to leave all this dangling. Find a source for this book and give it away next Sunday. Get all you carnal people in church for a change. Another large vessel was the Dawn. Now, we've got Star of Peace, otherwise known as Lover Boy, and Smith below deck. And just as he reached the deck, and we've got Atlantic City. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a... I got him right there. And we've got Yamacraw by the mass. Well, let's add one more. Four covers the whole earth. Am I boring you? I just love to tell you bedtime stories. Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating out of... You know, the strange things happen in the Bermuda Triangle. Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating... What do you suppose causes all these things to happen in the Bermuda Triangle? Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating out of Key West. Oh, one of the most famous stories about the Devil's Triangle is the story of the ghost ship Connemara 4. One of the most mysterious occurrences in the Devil's Triangle. Well, let's go back to the Dawn. What happened to Yamacraw? I lost the place on Yamacraw. Oh, there it is. I hope I got enough fingers to hold all these things down. On deck, back to the Yamacraw. If you weren't so smart, I wouldn't be able to jump around like this. You'd forget where I was. That's the way I eliminate the ones that shouldn't be listening to me. On deck, visibility was absolutely zero. I'm on the Yamacraw now, and the mass is out there. Some of the men, groping their way around the Yamacraw's deck, commented that the substance into which they had steam felt like suspended particles of fine sand or dust. Yet there was no movement of the mass, as there would have been had it been one of those rare dust storms at sea. The air was dead still. The ship moved forward with just enough way to maintain steerage. The radar screen showed only a green clutter. The ship's compasses still worked. Suddenly, there was a spontaneous... Now, that's where we were, wasn't it? I wanted to be sure I could find it again. In the Devil's Triangle, I included the story of the ghost ship Connemara 4, which to me was one of the most mysterious occurrences in the Devil's Triangle. So be it. Back to Dawn. Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating out of Key West. Are you jumping ship with me? The Dawn was typical of the shrimp boats that dragged the waters of the Atlantic coast from the Virginia Cape south around Florida and into the Gulf of Mexico. White hull and superstructure. Got a picture of old Black Hull and superstructure here. There's old Black Hull and superstructure. See you right there, W333, white superstructure and Black Hull. Now, Dawn, white superstructure and white hull. white hull and superstructure with black trim, and nets hanging from her booms when not in use. You gotta watch them all. There's something tricky about them all. I'm telling you, you can't drop your guard. Wherever a hull is, you gotta watch it. Nets hanging from her booms when not in use. I have trouble visualizing that. And I'm usually pretty imaginative. The dawn. That'll wake you up, all right. The dawn. Captain and home by Albert Clark of Key West was working the waters east of Florida Keys during late April 1975. Also aboard were two crewmen, Ralph Myers and George Parrish, both of St. Mary's, Georgia. The Shrimper Dawn was last seen on April 22nd, 10 miles northwest of Smith's Shoal Light, a small beacon by a passing boat. The Dawn, with three experienced seamen aboard, was never seen or heard from again. Seven aircraft, five Coast Guard, one Navy, and one Air Force searched over 8,200 square miles of ocean, but they found no trace of the missing Shrimper. The search ended almost exactly a year after the search for Saba Bank was terminated. Let's go back to am I boring you?
No,
we took care of Dawn. I finished her. In The Devil's Triangle, one, his other book, Richard Weiner says, I included the story of the ghost ship Connemara 4, which to me is one of the most mysterious occurrences in The Devil's Triangle. She was found crewless and adrift some 400 miles southwest of Bermuda in September 1955. The large yacht was somewhat battered, but still afloat and sound. Along Connemara 4's track from New York to where she was found, there passed Hurricane Connie during the second week in August, with winds up to 100 miles an hour. Less than a week later, Hurricane Diane, with its 125 miles per hour winds, roared over the exact same area, claimed more than 200 lives. The exact place where this boat, found crewless, but battered but still afloat and sound, it weathered two hurricanes. There was more to come for the yacht Connemara 4. Within 2 weeks, Hurricane Ione battered the identical sector of the Devil's Triangle with its 125 mile per hour winds. Most blue water sailors agree that for the crew of the yacht to have remained at sea continuously for a month and be belted to three hurricanes during that period would be almost beyond human endurance. The only mystery about the yacht Connemara 4 is how she managed to survive three consecutive hurricanes. One can only comprehend the ferocity of a hurricane at sea by living through the experience. But to survive one storm, to have another strike, even before the waves of the first have diminished, and then to have yet a third slam in is almost unthinkable. Sounds incredible, doesn't it? I too thought so until I received a letter from Mr. J.E. Chaloner of Barbados. Well, let's try another one. And the devil's trying, I'm making you mad. About half as mad as I get. I'm taking it out on you. But I'm really taking it out on them. About half as mad as I get when they don't call me. In the devil's triangle, the Rafukamaru. Now, the Rafukamaru is something we ought to consider. It made an uneventful passage across the Pacific, through the Panama Canal and into the Caribbean. But as the ship steamed past the Bahama Islands, the Japanese crew found the strange happenings were more than legend in the waters of the Western Atlantic. For the last that was ever heard from the freighter Rafukamaru was the code message, "Danger like dagger, come quick." Then silence. What happened to the Japanese ship? No oil slick, no wreckage remains. Another one to disappear without a trace. Well, let's leave Connemara 4 and go back to the... Oh! I forgot. Didn't I? Atlantic City. Plied westward, less than a day away from her destination, Newport News. Am I making the simple point that some strange things go on? After a while, you know, all these ships sort of blend together and it becomes one big blob of mystery, each with her own strange story. Less than a day from her destination, Newport News, Virginia, W.J. Moore of South Wales topped the Atlantic City's bridge. Soon it'd be time to waken the rest of the crew, ready the ship for entering port. Morris was joined by the officer of the watch. They chatted a few moments. Suddenly the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild. This is where we were, right? Zigzagging and circling erratically. You can turn the cooler back on now. Getting heated up. Then the two men saw. Your nerves are on edge. You don't really believe I'll finish. You think I'm going to do it again. As your faith is, I was going to finish, but I picked it up from your vibrations. I picked it up from you. They have no faith in me. You're to blame. They're to blame, folks. I would have finished. But they're releasing all these negative vibes in here. Suddenly the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging and circling erratically. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great ball of fire, traveling rapidly and heading directly for the ship. Now apologize. Then you aren't either. You're lying. You're just saying whatever you think will keep me going. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great ball of fire, traveling rapidly and heading directly for the ship. It was on a collision course with the Atlantic City. Panicking. Understandable. Am I boring you? Panicking. Morris began to jump over the wind dodger to the foredeck below. The mate grabbed him and pulled him back to the deck. The two terrified men lay there covering their faces. Hearing no noise whatsoever, they looked up. The fireball was nearly upon them. Its glare made them squint, making no roar or noise whatsoever. It Now let's go to the mass. By the way, I have seen demoniac forces at work on just about some of the wildest continents of this world. I have gone to the Spirit to service in Brazil, not the one they take the tourists to, the real McCoy. But I have seen nothing to match devil worship in Haiti. And if you don't think there are unexplainable things and powers at work in the demon world, you need to see the real McCoy in Haiti. Devil worship, as I have never seen anywhere in the world. Well, let's go back to the Star of Peace. Okay? Early in the afternoon, Smith went below to check the compressor. You remember that one? The tank being filled registered only 1,500 pounds. The safety tolerance was over 3,000. Another 10 to 15 minutes would fill it, and no way it would reach the maximum amount. Smith headed topside. Just as he reached the deck. Now, I want to start something else. Did you ever hear about the coffins that danced? Strange. You know, it's not limited to ships and disappearances. We found things underwater, we found things on water, and found things above water. Here's a goodie. In Barbados, between 1811 and 1820, there occurred a series of events so bizarre and sacrilegious that witnesses were totally baffled by what they had seen. The May 1945 issue of the Journal of the Barbados Museum and Historical Society contained a documented account of this unresolved and unsolved mystery. There's a crypt there. The crypt slightly over 12 feet by 6 inches inside. Here's a picture of it. What are you doing over there? My Lord of mercy. I'm reading from The Devil's Triangle 2, Richard Weiner. You don't move as fast as you did before you got married. You're slowing down, man. Fact or legend? There's the crypt. See, it's open? Now let me talk to you about it. The crypt, slightly over 12 feet by 6 feet inside, is constructed of coral blocks cemented together so tightly that the walls appear to be a continuation of the lower portion, which was hacked out of the solid coral rock upon which the cemetery sits. The single entrance was sealed by a huge block of blue marble that weighed nearly 1,000 pounds. See, some of these happenings in the triangle, one or two of them, you can give a natural explanation to, maybe. But it keeps piling up. The single entrance was sealed by a huge block of blue marble that weighed nearly 1,000 pounds. When sealed, the tomb was virtually impenetrable. In July 1807, the casket containing the body of Mrs. Thomasina Goddard was deposited in the vault. A year later, another coffin holding the remains of 2-year-old Mary Ann Maria Chase, who had died of one of the many childhood diseases so prevalent in those days, was placed alongside the one holding Mrs. Goddard. For the next 4 years, the crypt remained closed. Then Dorcas Chase, little Mary Ann's older sister, was interred on July 6, 1812. Just a month later, Thomas Chase would follow his daughter to the grave. After the huge marble slab was removed, lantern-carrying graveyard workers descended into the chamber to ready it for the deposition of Thomas Chase's body. It took only a few seconds for the laborer's eyes to adjust to the semi-darkness in the tomb.
This is the end of Side 3.